Hi there, global citizens. Welcome back to the podcast that inspires a borderless mindset around manifesting a new world. I am your host, Florence Adu, coming to you from Accra. And my guest is coming to us from, I believe this is our first interview from this country. So I'm excited about our conversation and to learn a little bit more about her country and her work. And I'm so interested to hear and explore our conversation because I don't know how long ago it was, but I read a book that features her country, and it's called The Old Drift. And it's an interesting journey of the way, the intersection of many lives coming together on a bit of activism in the end. And so it kind of echoes a little bit of what I believe our conversation will be like. So let's get right to it. She is an award-winning journalist, communications specialist, and cultural curator. She is co-founder of the Women's History Museum of Zambia, which was established in 2017 with the mandate to research and restore African indigenous narratives, knowledge, and living histories focused on women. She has curated exhibitions and written papers focused on indigenous African knowledge systems and narratives in Zambia, but also for art spaces, museums, and universities such as National Museums of World Cultures in Sweden, Yale University in the US, Wendy Brow Center in South Africa, and many more. She has been recognized as 100 Most Influential Africans by Quartz New York and one of 40 Most Influential Africans. She's also a Google Podcast creator, so she's a fellow podcaster. Yay! She's a TEDx Lusaka speaker and is a Museum Lab Fellow for 2022. Samba Yonga, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Well, yes, I'm so excited. So let's get right to it. Where are you from? Where are you local? And what is your craft?
I'm from Lusaka, Zambia. My name is Samba Yonga. I'm local in Lusaka, which is the capital city of Zambia. Zambia is like a very big country. So I think it's like 1,200 kilometers to the northern border, so it's quite big. And I am a comms specialist, originally a journalist, and transitioned into communications. And while working in communications, I became fascinated with the way we understand who we are and how we communicate that and how that impacts our work. And I realized it also had to do with our historical understanding and perception of who we were. And that led us to eventually set up the Women's History Museum that really digs deep into identity, source communities, you know, indigenous knowledge systems, and that's how it all began.
Tell us a little bit more about your Lusaka, because Lusaka, I'm sure, is a large city. Mm. Give us a view into the streets and the sounds of your Lusaka.
Oh, people who visit Lusaka call it sleepy. But I call it noise because I'm not a city girl. I'm a country girl. I grew up in the city, but I prefer the country. But it's a laid back city. It only gets noisy during traffic time in the morning and in the evening. We've got three main highways where all the traffic flows through. And in between those highways is all the residential areas and the central business district. And we've got several malls dotted around that. And all around that, we've got all these communities where people live, work, and play.
So you mentioned that you found that communication was the way to understand us. And so take us back to the point in your upbringing, in your life, when you understood that that was for you.
So my dad used to be a diplomat. And every morning, you'd have to listen to the BBC early in the morning. So inadvertently, I got to understand and learn what's happening in the world, even if I didn't fully understand at the young age of 5 and 6 when I started becoming aware. Like, oh, do you remember? I don't know if you ever remember, but BBC Africa used to start off with this cock crow, like,
yeah,
remember that? Yeah, so My mornings always began like that, with dad's radio on, and then the headlines being read out, and then the news being read. And I think about it now, but I didn't realize it then, or even when I started my career, that there was a connection. So I think because of listening to all those stories from around the world, I was fascinated with the world. And in school, I became fascinated with social studies and geography and civics and all of that. And the idea of telling stories. So I think that's when it began.
Okay, got it. So I understand that you've lived abroad in terms of schooling, et cetera. So tell us why the where. How did you come to be living, working, and playing where you currently are located?
So my dad ended his diplomatic service when I was around 10, 11, and we came back to Zambia, continued my schooling here in Zambia, and I did my undergrad here. And I think even when I did my undergrad, I was always like, journalism is what I want to do. My parents were not 100% sure about it. They were like, really, journalism? What are you going to do? Work for the state-run newspaper? And which is what I had to do when I completed. But I didn't like it because I didn't find it stimulating. I found it quite boring and restrictive. I think that's the correct word. And I wanted something more challenging, something much more that will speak to my ideas and passions, which were not very defined at the time. But I just knew the state-run media was not for me. And that's how I moved into development journalism.
Okay, that's interesting. So did that take you around the continent very much, or were you kind of focused on Southern Africa?
Yeah, so in the beginning, we did a lot of community journalism and social journalism. So I worked for a paper, which then turned into a magazine called Trendsetters, and it focused on reproductive health. And at the time, there was a huge push for health communications and development. So it was interesting because it was delving deep into, it was kind of like investigative journalism because it was talking about stuff that mainstream media wasn't talking about, subjects that people weren't getting into, like reproductive health for young people, and talking about sexual gender-based violence when early in, before anybody was really talking about it, and it became a trend, you know, youth identity, youth development. That was all interesting to me because I was also, you know, I was 22 and I was editor of this magazine. So that was really interesting. And I think that influenced a lot of my later decisions in life when I started doing more development work in the region. And I started working for an international magazine that had Africa papers, and I became the regional editor for that. So I think that's what started my regional work as well, because then I went into production and I went into consulting as well.
Okay. So it sounds like at a very early age, you had an interesting leadership role in a paper. So being an editor of a magazine at such an early age, tell us a little bit about how you went about managing, because you're this young woman and we know the context often in the work that we, or the spaces that we are. How did you navigate leading teams and leading the mission, so to speak, at an early age, particularly in retrospect, looking at where you are now in your career?
I think it was really, what was really great about being part of the team at Trendsetters is that we were all a young group of people and we were all learning and growing at the same time. And that was a chance to kind of like bring in all our ideas, all our mistakes, and find new ways in how to communicate, because we were also moving away from what we had been shown and seen as how the media works. So we literally created new platforms, new ways of communicating, new communication tools, new styles. So I think we were one of the first kind of publications and media houses that used the creative way of design, imagery, to kind of bring in the message and attract a certain demographic, which was obviously the young people who are our target market. And it was a very enriching, sometimes scary space to be, because you're learning as you're going, but you're also in a group of people who are equally as excited, equally as energetic and creative. It was great, yeah.
And so fast forwarding now, done this journalistic endeavor, and then you've transitioned into your own consulting business, right? So tell us about your consulting business. Tell us about how you've now emerged as a media consultant in the space, and what it was like just kind of building that business as an entrepreneur.
Yeah. So after having done the regional work, I realized that I was on the wrong side of the storytelling. And I was like, yeah, I don't want to tell the story anymore, because as a result of doing the problem with doing development work, the nature of development work means you're speaking to somebody's agenda, especially if you're working with development agencies. So whether it's your UN, whether it's a global development agency, and that comes with funding, and the funding kind of finances the work that you're doing, finances the your journalistic work or the reports that you're creating, who you're talking to, what the output will be. So increasingly, I kept on feeling like, I know this story is valid and it serves a purpose. Development is important, and reporting the hard parts of development, which was often poverty, gender-based violence, how to empower communities, all of that stuff was important. But what I didn't like was the fact that it felt like we had no control on how we develop ourselves, that we were relying on some template from a different organization or a different country to tell us what to do. And every time we interacted with those countries or organizations, it was like we were putting out a begging bowl and being like, help us, we're so poor, and that was the constant narrative. I was just like, I'm sorry, I can't do this anymore. Because I knew with all the other work that I was doing, at that point I'd already gotten into production work, being commissioned to be part of TV series where we had traveled to Ghana, to South Africa, to all these places. And I'm just like, yeah, this Africa that I'm talking about here is not the Africa that I experienced. It's not the only Africa that I experienced.
Sure.
So I don't want to do this work anymore. And that's how I decided to then go and do my master's. And then when I came back, I set up Kuatenga Media. And it was very intentional that when setting up that company, that we would be providing communication services that give a different view of Africa, a different view of Zambia, and tell a different side of the story. And we would be curating those narratives.
That's great. So that's where you are now. And so you are in an interesting narrative space, because that has also grown into something. So as I mentioned in your bio, that is this, I want to say, bigger than life kind of dream, I would imagine, in terms of the museum. So tell us, so you're in this consulting space, and then you have this. So tell us how the idea came to you, how you assembled the team. What is it like to open or to create a museum?
Right. So the museum is very fascinating, the way it came about. It's kind of linked to already the story of why Kuatenga Media was also set up. Mm-hmm. We set it up as a way to kind of shift the narratives of Africa. And then the more we got into that space and started understanding, the dynamics of our political and social history and the impact on our contemporary lives, for example, what our historical education has done to how we understand how we live in our societies. For example, why do people live in shanty compounds? Why is it only, settler white people who control companies? Why is it that, when we're making business decisions at a very high economic level with politicians, we're always deferring to the foreign companies? Why don't, all that stuff we came across during our work with Kuatenga, and I always wanted to understand why we make certain decisions as Zambians. And it's not only Zambians, you'd see it play out in other countries as well. So I'd always speak to Mulenga Kapwepo, who was a cultural and historical specialist, and she would often tell these stories of our indigenous culture and then also our colonial and post-colonial experience. And it started becoming apparent to me that it had something more to do with how our experience of colonialism and post-colonialism affects how we make decision, and still affects how we make decision. And I wanted to go deeper into that, into understanding the why. And then it started becoming more apparent that if we dig deep into the why and find a way to counter it, maybe this is something that could start transforming how we view ourselves, which inevitably impacts how we make decisions. And a lot of those things we found in our history, because when we'd understand how we'd interact historically, how our source communities made decisions, the democratic way, you know, they entered negotiations, or the nutritional aspect of how we lived, or the leadership roles that we had historically, they made much more sense. They were much more democratic, they were much more engaging, inclusive, and it resulted in communities that were harmonious, that were productive. And we started wondering why we don't borrow from that. Like, why doesn't contemporary Zambia borrow from what was obviously a very valuable knowledge system? And we realized it had a lot to do with our own identity crisis and inferiority. I would call it a collective inferiority, where colonialism disrupted and devalued who we were. And we had been unable since then to kind of like reclaim our own value. And it became apparent that this is the work that we need to do to try and reclaim that value and restore who we were as a people. And that's the museum, yeah.
Okay. So getting down to the actual curation and thinking about the vision for taking it from a digital concept to a physical concept to a center that might be someplace where people are actually coming together and scholarship and all those things. Where 5 years on, where are you and where do you see yourself moving next?
Right. So I think, you know, when we started, we didn't think that it would end up or even get to the stage. I think it was an experiment. In many ways, it still is. The reason why we set it up as a digital space is that we didn't want to wait for a building for us to be able now to start communicating the work that we're doing. And I think that has really worked well, because we've been able then to democratize the space. And we've been able to do research and collaborate and produce work that has become new knowledge, that is being used, that is being consumed, and new ways of museum making, because that's a big discussion now. The discourse is really huge in terms of entangled memories, the idea of museum making and the future of museums, big part of the conversation in the space. And we feel very privileged that we're able to be a part of that conversation and contribute to it, such that now when we're building the museum, we're working on the actual physical structure of the museum. It will allow us to reimagine museums in a new way, because remember, museum is not African. The concept of a museum is a very European and Eurocentric way of producing knowledge, but it is the standard of producing knowledge. And even when we know that museum knowledge in terms of ethnographic collections they have from Africa are highly problematic, very distorted, decontextualized, and dislocated. So all the knowledge that is contained there is already problematic. And now there is a big wave to kind of like undo a lot of that work. And even as we're building our museum, we're very conscious of that and want to be aware that we're not repeating the same infrastructural ecosystem that is Eurocentric. We're thinking of what a museum would look like for an African purpose. And we don't have museums in Africa. The concept of museums doesn't exist in Africa. We live our histories, you know, in our communities. They're lived histories. And so we're bringing that into the museum space as well. And that's a huge consideration for us.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess when I think about it, I mean, would our museums have been monuments? Like, is that how we've lived it? But then somehow we've also passed down our histories, right? And passed down our stories. Yeah. And so I guess our museum concepts are our people.
Yes, exactly. so that we store our knowledge in the people, so that we call them knowledge keepers. So they're oral archives. And for many reasons, obviously one of the reasons why we're excavating that knowledge from the oral archives and documenting it is because they pass on. In the ancient times, why we were able to maintain those living histories is because it was a very well-practiced ritualistic practice where from generation to generation, the oral archive was passed on and passed on and passed on. And, you know, it's through our objects that we created, that history and knowledge remained. But because of historical, political, and social disruptions, that no longer happens. So obviously we have to think of a new way of storing and preserving these narratives. And this is some of the work that we're trying to develop.
So one of the, I want to say, outgrowths of the museum project is your Leading Ladies podcast.
Yes.
Yes, which I love so much because me being a creator and in the space where I particularly am focused on information and knowledge sharing for children and families, just seeing this was like, oh my goodness, this is probably such a gem for Zambian parents. I mean, Africa-wide, obviously. So I think we all should know everything about the continent. But just first and foremost, just to have the series of this information to know more about particularly women. And we're in Women's History Month, so it's all also very relevant. But I think always understanding and celebrating women. So you were a Google podcaster. You won because I've applied. So kudos to you for being one. So tell us about the journey of getting it funded and then even coming up with a concept and then getting it funded and then how you continue to sustain it and create more content each season.
Mm. So I think it was very exciting because my co-founder, Mulenga Zakwepe, had done some research around, you know, the colonial documents that were in the National Archives. And she found in the footnotes, like the colonial officers would narrate, because what would happen, I don't know whether it's like, because I'm aware West Africa is not really a settler community. So I'm not sure how colonial systems and infrastructures work then. But in Zambia, what would happen is like the colonial officers would move into the districts. And when they're in the districts, they would document everything, all the ways of life of people, you know, who was a problematic, who was not, who was able to be controlled, the method of how they were going to use to infiltrate. They documented all of that stuff. So you'd find sometimes in the footnotes they'd have notes about people who are being a problem. Maybe they need to look into this further or whatever. And oftentimes in those same footnotes and sometimes in the main documents, you'd find these stories of these women who they felt were problematic and they had to do something to control them and whatever. So that, from that stemmed the idea, well, like, why don't we create narratives out of these women who are actually footnotes? And it was brilliant because these women, if you look at the, if you compare them to archetypes, you associate them to masculine archetypes, to men. You know, they were generals and they were heads of states and they were, you know, negotiators, they were politicians. And you wouldn't think of them as women, but these were women in the 18th and 19th century who had those roles. So we thought this would be a really great way to kind of show that women's leadership is not something new, that women held very significant roles in our history and have impacted the nation building process through colonialism, post-colonialism. And that's how we came up with the idea of the Leading Ladies. We're initially going to make it an audio podcast, but I felt that, you know, this is an opportunity to reimagine, you know, what our world was and to create and build a universe around it. And so we decided to make it an animation, a mini podcast animation. And it worked really well because then we could reach more demographics. And when we presented it to Hebos, they really liked the idea. It was something fresh. It's something that had not been done before. And it touched on a number of issues to do with women's participation, but also democracy, but then also indigenous knowledge systems. So that was very interesting. And I think it was appealing and is still a unique selling position when we talk to funders and they're interested in the narrative, because then it allowed us to do different Southern African countries as well. Because since then, we've done Zimbabwe, we've done Malawi, we've done South Africa as well. Yeah. So, yeah, it was really interesting in that way.
Nice. So you mentioned expanding this to other countries, and so that obviously requires collaboration. But as you're kind of getting on your feet on the street, I want to kind of take you back to the ground and the groundwork that you do and ask you about Glocal Speak. So we want to hear what you hear. So I ask you to share a word, a phrase, or a saying that is a meaningful part of your local experience. And it could be local, where you felt very local, or something that's poignant. But yes, a word, phrase, or saying that is a meaningful part of your local experience and why you come to value it as Glocal Speak.
Oh, I think there are many, but the one I can think of that a lot of Zambians use is this term called give us. You know,
give us.
Like now it's the way you say it. It's the English words give us, but it's just the way you say it. So it's usually in the context of like if somebody is doing something really fabulous or, you know, we want to experience something amazing, you're like, give us the way. Like you, give us the experience. Exactly. Yeah.
Nice. So say it again. You say give us Iwe.
Yeah, you say give us Iwe. Yeah.
Iwe. Okay. And what language is that?
Like, so it's a term, give us Iwe. Iwe is a Nyanja.
Nyanja. Ah, okay.
It's a lingua franca that is kind of like a mixture of Ngoni from the south. But it's on the east of our country, yeah.
Ah, interesting. So Ngoni is, so just thinking about the different tribes culturally in Zambia, what is your ethnic heritage and background, and what are the languages that you have learned over the, or from your mother tongue?
So my mother tongue is Lubale, and we're from the northwest of Zambia. It borders Angola. So my mom is actually Angolan. Yeah, so I have cousins from Angola and Zambian relatives as well. But and then I also speak Nyanja Bemba, Nyanja the language I spoke, Bemba, and Tonga, which is three other ethnic languages from the south and the east.
Wow. So were those picked up just kind of in experiencing life with people, or did you actually study them in school?
Well, Nyanja was a subject in school, but we you know, because we interact a lot, like Bemba and Nyanja are kind of the languages that are spoken the most in our communities. So you kind of have to pick them up and learn them as you grow. Yeah. And then obviously I speak my mother tongue because we speak it at home as well.
Got it. Interesting. I mean, that's the story of most Africans, is that they've picked up a lot of languages just because of interacting and being with their people. So, or
exactly.
The people. Yeah. Okay. So now you mentioned the kind of the process of getting to the podcast and putting those stories together and expanding that. And you kind of started to mention where you're taking museum. I listened to one of your interviews and you mentioned the brick and mortar and how you have a massive amount of land, as far as I can understand. And so tell us a little bit more about how acquiring the land came into the business, because what I'm trying to understand is you kind of have this nonprofit function and then you have this for-profit function, if I can, you know, assume that that is kind of the museum, is this nonprofit and for-profit function. So how are you maintaining and operating those two businesses or functions on a regular basis, on a daily basis?
Right. I mean, so at the moment, the museum is mostly nonprofit. And what we want to do is create an opportunity. We're calling it, we call the concept from museum to market, where we can show what indigenous knowledge systems can create value for the creative and cultural economy. So that is something that is really interesting for us to do, because we realize that a lot of indigenous knowledge systems are being appropriated and being commercialized in other spaces, particularly the global north. And we're like, so how can we ensure that we're protecting that knowledge, we're patenting it, but then also bringing into contact with creative and cultural actors so that it can be used to then impact the bottom line for the creative and cultural sector. So that's something that's very interesting for us and that we're wanting to develop. So this is more at kind of like policy, infrastructure, and ecosystem level that will continue then to trickle down and impact the sector, our certain home. So in that way, that's where maybe you can look at it in terms of being involved and being an actor in an economic sense. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
I like that. It does to some degree. I'm asking this because I think about David Adjaye, who has designed museums, you know, in Africa, and that's something that he's done quite well. He's a, you know, fellow Ghanaian. And so when I think about the space, I'm thinking of like, where will they go with their space, and where will they go with, because I think the non-physical space is awesome. And I think just to your point about being able to make this museum to market concept work, it is excellent because you have this digital archive that is always this living museum. So it doesn't have to stay static in a physical place. And then you have what are kind of these archival pieces that you're kind of straddling the line of like, do we want to keep them and call them ours and, you know, appropriate this, that, or the other. So then when you think about all the space that you have to potentially put together a physical space, what is it that you want to see for yourselves and for the communities that would be interacting in those spaces?
Yeah, I mean, so in all the work that we've been doing, that has been a huge part of it. Our architects, they're called Mass Design, and they're amazing. And we partnered with them, and they really want to work in designing, bringing out our vision. So we had to go through this process, ideation process, where we were asked kind of like, you know, if a person comes into the museum, and they exit the museum, what is the experience that you want them to have had? And the idea is that once they enter the space and they leave, they transform into something different. Part of that is that we want to borrow from our ritualistic and ceremonial practices where, you know, people went through certain teachings at different points in their lives to learn how to be a certain type of citizen or a certain type of member of society. And through that experience, they learned of who they are, their identity, life skills, you know, how to do certain things. So the museum would be a part of that process as well, using your senses to learn things, because we learn with our bodies. So that was a big part of the design, or is a big part of the process of design. Then also just like physically, what do we want it to look like? Because, you know, the four concrete walls is not very practical. It's not how we live as Africans. It's not our way of living. So we're very much also thinking of a concept of inside, outside. Like, you know, we want it to be more like inside, outside. And the design of the building should follow that as well, right? Because we want to be close to nature, because that's our original way of being. And that it makes sense even in, for our climate, for environmental sustainability, because that's a big part of it as well. So we're thinking through all these ideas and design elements as we go through the process of designing.
I like that. So African. I love it. Like,
yeah.
I'm looking forward to when that happens, and I enjoy the space now. So that's wonderful. So in that same vein of thought, I want to ask you about a mindset hack. And so I want to ask you, what is your favorite or an innovative mindset hack? And this is one that you practice, one that you know of, or one that you can imagine.
I found for me, I do this thing where I gestate. So I consume, I go through a process. Sometimes it's conscious, sometimes it's unconscious, where I'm just consuming information. And I do this a lot when I know I'm going through a creative process. If I want to write something, or I want to think of an idea, I want to develop a concept. So then I'll just allow myself moments where I'm consuming. It doesn't matter what it is. It can be a documentary, it can be a book, it can be articles. And so if I turn my phone to the side and show you a stack of books that's on my table, it can be documentary. So I'll do this thing. It can even be series. I can spend a whole day like looking at watching series, and then I'll just allow stuff to just date for a period of maybe a week, sometimes 2 days. And then when I sit down, it will just come out. The concept and everything will come out. Yeah. I don't know what happens like in the.
Yeah. Just like mixes up. I like that. That's a great tool. That's a great hack. Like it's just it marinates and then.
It's marinating. Yeah. And then it comes out in one go. So I'm not the kind of person who does like, I'll write.
My
current writing partner is having a problem with that because they're wanting me to give them pages every day. But I don't do that. Like I need the time and then I'll write everything in one go and then give it. Yeah. And then I don't do the writing every day.
Sure. And every writer has a process. So that's, what are you writing currently?
So I'm working on a concept for a series.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the first time I've said that out loud.
Okay. That means it's the fruition is coming.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. Okay. So we'll be looking out for that one. And we didn't really talk that much about your production work. What is your favorite type of production area? If you can just share that in terms of, is it documentary? Is it nonfiction? What kind of?
I used to think it was documentary because naturally that's the kind of work that we also do for our communication services. We do a lot of documentary work. Now I think it's still documentary because I love that investigative aspect of it, but it's definitely now not to do so much as the format, but the content. Yeah. So I think now I'm gravitating more towards a lot of the work that naturally, they're gravitating more towards centering historical narratives, investigating historical narratives, writing stories and characters that are, whether fictionally or realistically, impacted by our historical frameworks. So I think that's what interests me more. So it doesn't matter what the format is, but I think the subject matter, I'm very sure that's what I'm interested in. Yeah, that's what I'm writing about. Yeah.
Okay, nice. So this is a good lead way into, you know, Asamba, who's not the businesswoman who's doing all those things, but the woman who is sometimes in her leisure. And so would you say that you're a reader, a watcher, or a listener? And what are some of your favorite reads, watches, or listens?
I think I do all of the above. Is that allowed? I do all of the above.
Yes. So please share, because I'm sure you have a rich deck of reads, watches, and listens that you might want to share with our listeners.
Yeah. So at the moment, I've been reading a friend's manuscript. She just finished writing her novel. So I'm like reading that. It's also historically based, but it's fiction. Really interesting. So I do this thing where I also read several books at the same time.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm.
It's not very effective, but, you know, kind of works. kind of works. And I've also just finished reading Of Spirit and Water, which is so transforming for me, by Patrice Malidoma Some. I recommend it for everyone to read. It's incredible. And then I just got a book. Somebody gifted me the book for 491 Days, The Winnie Mandela Story, one of the Winnie Mandela stories. So I'll be reading that as well. So they're all stacked on the side of somewhere. And I always need to have like a wallpaper magazine or a Vanity Fair, because those are my favorite.
Okay.
Yeah, for like aesthetic stimulation. That's what I call it.
Sure. Yeah, they look good.
Exactly. Yeah, and then watching, I think I'm watching a lot of things. I'm into Eastern dramas because I think their narrative form is very strong, even if they're such simple stories.
So when you say Eastern dramas, do you mean like Bollywood?
No, so I don't watch that much Bollywood. So it's mostly Korean, Japanese.
Ah, okay, okay. Yeah, Korean. Got it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Korean and Japanese. And then I'm also watching, I'm avoiding watching Luther because I think I still need to watch the last episode of the last series, although this one is a film. But I see that it's, everybody is watching it. And I love Chef's Table. That's a staple. I do that. It's almost calming, but also like the narrative structure is so compelling. And it's something that the creator did with the way he really brings out the emotion of the chef. So it no longer becomes a story about food. It becomes a story about history, identity, and place. He does that really well with food. Yeah, so I find that really fascinating, that kind of storytelling, very fascinating. Yeah. And listen podcasting. So, lately I've been listening to, so I've got this series of podcasts that I listen to depending on my mood. And then I also do Audible a lot.
Yes.
Because sometimes I want to read books and read them, but sometimes when I want to just listen to certain things and their books, I'm like, let's do that as well. But consistently now I've been listening to Ratchet and Respectable.
Okay.
Which is this. Do you know her?
I've heard of it. I get the some snippets.
I listen to it because it's this lady who, American, I think she used to be some kind of
comedian, I think.
You know, creative or comms person. Yeah. But she worked at BET and something. And I think now she's into film or series. But she's traveling around Africa. I found that interesting. I think she was in Ghana. She was in Ghana and now she's in South Africa. And
yes. Yeah, I saw clips of her. Demetria Lucas, right?
Yes, Demetria Lucas. That's her name.
Yeah. Yeah. She was, I saw her, I think in the holidays Okay. Yep.
Yeah, so she's down in South Africa. And I just find it interesting that she's traveling. Because that's something I want to do, actually. I'm thinking of remote working and traveling around Africa.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So I'm listening to her just to understand her experience. The content is not so compelling because she talks about popular culture and stuff like that. But, but my staple podcasts are The Moth, Hidden Brain, TED Radio Hour. Those are some I always listen to. And The Comb, which is a BBC. I like The Comb. I'm still struggling. I can't, now. And I love that we've gotten the chance to chat. Other day I was on Salam and Hello. And I'm like, great. So now I have a staple of African podcasts that I can listen to all the time and learn. Because I'm craving that. Yeah.
Well, I try to cover guests that live all over Africa. So maybe there's some guests that might give you some insights into some new places you might want to relocate to.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
And so I'm so excited. So, the Global Citizens will be on my list and Salam and Hello. So I'm looking for more. So if you know any other African podcasts as well, please let me know. Yeah.
I will. Most definitely. Well, Samba, thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for your energy and just for everything. Your work is so, it just makes my heart sing that there's this happening, and it's happening in a place that, I don't think many people know so much about Zambia, but all of Southern Africa is supremely beautiful, and it has such this richness that I think that often, I don't know if we take it for granted, but just this, that knowledge is not there. So I think that by you placing women in a place and telling these stories, I think it kind of helps to transport people's minds to experiencing it and maybe even coming and seeing it. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much. It was really lovely. Thank you for reaching out. It's really meaningful for us when we get connected with other people on the continent. It means that the work that we're doing is valuable and it's being seen. And it's always good to learn from other Africans as well. It's the most enriching process, I think.
Indeed, indeed. So before we sign off, do you have any last words that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I think and I've been saying this lately at all our events, it's really just to follow our instincts. I mean, I was saying to people that, you know, our Zambia is not unique in our experience. It's an experience that a lot of African countries go through as well at different degrees. For example, West Africa, because they don't have a settler community, I feel that they're much more, not necessarily empowered, but they identify more with who they are in a much more confident way than perhaps, you know, we do. But we're coming into ourselves. And I'm saying to all the people I interact with, like, trust that instinct, trust that gut, especially the young people, because we've seen a huge rush of them now coming to all our events. They want to find out more about their history and culture. And these are a lot of them are third culture kids.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them are even kids from, even if it's the rural area, but they've kind of like been separated from their practices and, you know, are being pushed more into this modern way of life. So they're starting to remember and they're like, oh, should I be doing this? And we're saying, yes, you should be. Trust your instinct. Follow it. It's leading you down the right path. Yeah.
Wonderful. Those are great last words. So thank you so much. Thank you again.
Thank you.
All right, Glocal Citizens, this has been another episode of the podcast. You can catch us Tuesdays with new episodes at GlocalCitizensPod.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Please remember to like, share, subscribe, tell a friend. The show notes are always rich, folks. So again, you can find the museum. You could find everything about Samba in our show notes. So please, please visit. So until next time, bye for now.